Good afternoon, everyone. If you are sitting here just to have lunch and didn't know there's going to be a poetry reading, you are here in the midst of a poetry reading. My name is Laura Bayless, and I wanted to welcome you to MoMA and to our Modern Poets series. Today's program is dedicated to Frank O'Hara's lunch poems, and it's a special opportunity to revisit this great city as the great poet evoked it through his lunch poems. Frank O'Hara worked at the Museum of Modern Art from 1951 to 1966, with occasional time away. In 1951, he began working at the museum's front desk and then became a special assistant in the international program. Later, he was an associate curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture, and he organized the exhibitions The New Spanish Painting in 1960, Robert Motherwell in 1965, David Smith in 1966, and Nakin in 1966 as well. He also wrote plays and collaborated with visual artists on numerous works and published countless books of poetry. He died in 1966. While he worked at MoMA, he often spent his lunch breaks walking the streets of Midtown Manhattan. The fruits of these walks are in his small little book, Lunch Poems, which looks like this, and which you can find in MoMA's first floor bookstore if you're interested. Today, poet, translator, editor, teacher, and doctoral candidate Stefania Heim, whose full bio you can find on the back of your program, is here to share with all of us her favorite of Frank O'Hara's lunch poems right at the beginning of our lunch breaks. And next week, you can come back to the same spot next Friday at noon when poet Wayne Kostenbaum comes to read his favorite lunch poems. Our hope is that after this reading, you'll hit the same streets that Frank roamed, you'll notice things you never noticed, become mesmerized by them, and need to write a poem. And I encourage you to share your poems with us, so please take note of the insert in your program, which Stefania will review with you later, and make sure to send us what you've come up with at the email address listed. Our favorites will be posted on MoMA's blog on June 29th. I also want to thank our AV staff and thank Maureen O'Hara, Frank's sister, who is here, for her support of this program always. And without further ado, I want to welcome the wonderful Stefania Heim.
Hi, everyone. Thank you to Laura and to the wonderful education staff at MoMA. It is really exciting to see you all here today. There are a number of reasons why it's thrilling to read Frank O'Hara's poems here and today. And the first and most obvious is his connection to MoMA. So as Laura was talking about how he started working here at the front desk in 1951 when he was just 25 to be close to the art, and then came back in 1955 and curated shows and continued working here through his death. And then there's also the story of how the lunch poems were written, right, which is so perfect as to seem almost apocryphal, how O'Hara would take his lunch breaks here, wander the streets of Midtown, gathering impressions and observations, and return to the typewriter at his desk and bring them back to life and the city back to life in these poems. O'Hara actually wrote the jacket copy to two lunch poems, which was published by City Lights in 1964. And this is what he writes to describe the book. Often this poet, strolling through the noisy, splintered glare of a Manhattan noon, has paused at a sample Olivetti to type up 30 or 40 lines of ruminations, or, pondering more deeply, has withdrawn to a darkened ware or firehouse to limn his computed misunderstandings of the eternal questions of life, coexistence, and depth, while never forgetting to eat lunch, his favorite meal. So just this perfect balance that he strikes there and in the poems of this sort of mythic tone of the poet pondering these, you know, unimaginable questions with the super quotidian, right? This is about lunch, so here we are at lunch. I'm especially excited because we're in that same noisy, splintered glare of a Manhattan noon, right, that he describes. And we have the, you know, the hum of the taxis and the cars that we can hear behind us. And you'll hear in the first poem I'll read how Frank O'Hara, in this moment of amazing synesthesia, brings that home back to life. And we are also cushioned by these walls and this art. So it's perfect lunch poem conditions. There's the simultaneity of the noise in the background, the passing impressions, and the poems. And reading and listening, we have to keep ourselves aware of all these various levels, right? So there's the hum, maybe a sundress passing by that we see, worries or thoughts that we're engaging in more deeply, whether we're hungry or not, whether we're eating, and then what the poems make happen in our minds and in our feelings. So I think these are perfect lunch poem conditions because that's what the lunch poems do, right? So that simultaneity of attention, the anticipation, the distraction, the revelation, the contradiction, are what they perform, what they are about, and what they make possible for us. So I'm just gonna read a few of these and maybe talk a little bit about them also. So the first one is called A Step Away From Them. And it's one of the more quintessential of the lunch poems. So he describes this whole situation in the first few lines. And we have the hum-colored cabs in the beginning. So A Step Away From Them. It's my lunch hour. So I go for a walk among the hum-colored cabs. First, down the sidewalk where laborers feed their dirty, glistening torsos, sandwiches, and Coca-Cola with yellow helmets on. They protect them from falling bricks, I guess. Then onto the avenues where skirts are flipping above heels and blow up over grates. The sun is hot, but the cabs stir up the air. I look at bargains in wristwatches. There are cats playing in sawdust. On to Times Square, where the sign blows smoke over my head, and higher, the waterfall pours lightly. A Negro stands in a doorway with a toothpick, languorously agitating. A blonde chorus girl clicks. He smiles and rubs his chin. Everything suddenly honks. It is 12:40 of a Thursday. Neon in daylight is a great pleasure, as Edwin Denby would write, as are light bulbs in daylight. I stop for a cheeseburger at Juliet's Corner. Giulietta Massina, wife of Federico Fellini, a bellatrice, and chocolate malted. A lady in foxes on such a day puts her poodle in a cab. There are several Puerto Ricans on the avenue today, which makes it beautiful and warm. First Bunny died, then John Latouche, then Jackson Pollock. But is the earth as full as life was full of them? And one has eaten and one walks past the magazines with nudes and the posters for Bullfight and the Manhattan storage warehouse, which they'll soon tear down. I used to think they had the armory show there. A glass of papaya juice and back to work. My heart is in my pocket. It is Poems by Pierre Reverti. So, you know, things just to notice that will keep coming back is all of these names that are in the poem. So some of them are famous. There's Giulietta Massina. He explains that. But then suddenly Bunny died. And Bunny is Bunny Lang, who is a good friend of his and one of the founders of the Poets Theater. Right. So all of these things sort of pile up. And in the end, you get the experience of reading and living is all tangled up, where his heart is actually the Book of Poems by Reverdy, which is a French poet who he particularly loved. And you'll see him keep coming back throughout these poems. The next one I'm going to read goes back a little bit. So the poems in Lunch Poems are actually organized chronologically by year. So this goes back to 1954, which is one of the earlier ones. And it's a little bit different. We're not at lunchtime in this one, where it's nighttime, so you have to suspend your disbelief for a second to be here. And it's one of the more sort of like quintessentially poemy poems, I think, in this book. It has tons of personification and really rich observation and detail. So it's called On the Way to San Remo. The black ginkgos snarl their way up. The moon growls at each blinking window. The apartment houses climb deafeningly into the purple. A bat hisses northwards. The perilous steps lead to a grate. Suddenly, the heat is bearable. The cross-eyed dog scratches a worn patch of pavement. His right front leg is maimed in the shape of a V. There's no trace of his nails. On the street, a woman cajoles. She is very old and dirty. She whistles her filthy hope that it will rain tonight. The Sixth Avenue bus trunk lumbers sideways. It is full of fat people who cough, as at a movie. They eat each other's dandruff in the flickering glare. The moon passes into clouds, so hurt by the streetlights of your glance, oh my heart. The act of love is also passing, like a subway bison, through the paper-littered arches of the express track. The sailor sobers, he feeds pennies to the peanut machines. Though others are in the night, faraway lips upon a dusty armpit, the nostrils are full of tears. High fidelity reposed in a box, a hand on the window pane. The sweet calm, the violin strings tie a young man's hair. The bright black eyes pin far away their smudged curiosity. Yes, you are foolish, smoking. The bars are for rabbits who wish to outlive the men. So this one is just titled Poem, a couple of poems in this book called Poem. And it has a bunch of, again, characters and figures. So some of them are O'Hara's friends. So there's Vincent, who is Vincent Warren, who's a dancer and had become O'Hara's lover. There's Grace Hartigan, the painter. And there's also, most importantly in this poem, Khrushchev. So it's 1959 when this is written, and Khrushchev is coming to New York. It's the height of the Cold War. And he arrives in the first sentence of this poem with an exclamation point. So, poem. Khrushchev is coming on the right day. The ghost of Khrushchev. Okay. Start that again. It's actually totally appropriate because in this poem you'll notice the line, everything is tossing. So everything is tossing. Poem. Khrushchev is coming on the right day. The cool, graced light is pushed off the enormous glass piers by hard wind, and everything is tossing. Hurrying on up, this country has everything but politesse. A Puerto Rican cab driver says, and five different girls I see look like Petey Gimble with her blonde hair tossing too. As she looked when I pushed her little daughter on the swing on the lawn, it was also windy last night when we went to a movie and came out. Ionesco is greater than Beckett, Vincent said. That's what I think. Blueberry blintzes, and Khrushchev was probably being carped at in Washington. No politesse. Vincent tells me about his mother's trip to Sweden. Hans tells us about his father's life in Sweden. It sounds like Grace Hartigan's painting, Sweden. So I go home to bed and names drift through my head. Purgatorio Machado, Gerhard Schwartz, and Gaspar Gonzalez, all unknown figures of the early morning as I go to work. Where does the evil of the year go when September takes New York and turns it into ozone stalagmites, deposits of light? So I get back up, make coffee, and read François Villon, his life so dark, New York seems blinding, and my tie is blowing up the street. I wish it would blow off, though it is cold and somewhat warms my neck. As the train bears Khrushchev on to Pennsylvania Station, and the light seems to be eternal, and joy seems to be inexorable, I am foolish enough to always find it in wind. This next one is called Personal Poem. And another thing I love about these poems is, you know, they're never the same when you read them. They are constantly shifting, and you notice new things. And you can read them and just let them sort of happen to you, or you can go and you can look up all the references and try and figure out what it is that O'Hara was talking about. And this one was written in 1959, and you'll notice the House of Seagram, right, which is the Seagram Building, which is the Mies van der Rohe and Philip Johnson skyscraper that had just been completed in 1958, so it would have been, it's kind of amazing to imagine it having been new in this moment where O'Hara is writing it and walking past it. Again, tons of references. Leroy here is Leroy Jones, now Amiri Baraka, the poet. And you'll notice also how current events come in. So the things that are happening, we have Miles Davis and other things. And also the wristwatch, which he was shopping for in that earlier poem I read, you'll see comes back. Also. So, personal poem. Now, when I walk around at lunchtime, I have only two charms in my pocket, an old Roman coin Mike Kanemitsu gave me, and a bolt head that broke off a packing case when I was in Madrid. The others never brought me too much luck, though they did help keep me in New York against coercion. But now I'm happy for a time, and interested. I walk through the luminous humidity, passing the House of Seagram with its wet and its loungers and the construction to the left that closed the sidewalk. If I ever get to be a construction worker, I'd like to have a silver hat, please, and get to Moriarty's where I wait for Leroy and hear who wants to be a mover and a shaker. The last 5 years, my batting average is 16, that's that. And Leroy comes in and tells me Miles Davis was clubbed 12 times last night outside Birdland by a cop. A lady asks us for a nickel for a terrible disease. but we don't give her one. We don't like terrible diseases. Then we go eat some fish and some ale. It's cool, but crowded. We don't like Lionel Trilling, we decide. We like Don Allen. We don't like Henry James so much. We like Herman Melville. We don't want to be in the Poets Walk in San Francisco even. We just want to be rich and walk on girders in our silver hats. I wonder if one person out of the 8 million is thinking of me as I shake hands with Leroy and buy a strap for my wristwatch and go back to work, happy at the thought, possibly so. And this one is called Adieu to Norman, Bonjour to Joan and Jean-Paul. And so the Joan in the title is the painter Joan Mitchell, who's a good friend of O'Hara's. There's a French street that appears in here, and it's a street where she had just gotten a studio in Paris where she was splitting her time with Jean-Paul Piopel. And so he's sort of thinking longingly about where Joan is. And I will confess that there are a number of French words in this poem, and I got some help here of the wonderful friend Sarah Jane, who helped me with my pronunciation, but just a little bit of a warning, I'm not totally comfortable, so apologies in advance if anyone is offended. So here this is, adieu to Norman, bonjour to Joan and Jean-Paul. It is 12:10 in New York, and I am wondering if I will finish this in time to meet Norman for lunch. Ah, lunch. I think I am going crazy with my terrible hangover and the weekend coming up at excitement-prone Kenneth Koch's. I wish I were staying in town and working on my poems at Joan's studio for a new book by Grove Press, which they will probably not print. But it is good to be several floors up in the dead of night, wondering whether you are any good or not. And the only decision you can make is that you did it. Yesterday, I looked up the Rue Frémicourt on a map and was happy to find it like a bird, flying over Paris at 16 environ, which unfortunately did not include Seine-et-Croix, which I don't know as well as a number of other things. And Alan is back talking about God a lot, and Peter is back not talking very much, and Joe has a cold and is not coming to Kenneth's. Although he is coming to lunch with Norman, I suspect he is making a distinction. Well, who isn't? I wish I were reeling around Paris instead of reeling around New York. I wish I weren't reeling at all. It is spring. The ice has melted. The Ricard is being poured. We are all happy and young and toothless. It is the same as old age. The only thing to do is simply continue. Is that simple? Yes, it is simple because it is the only thing to do. Can you do it? Yes, you can, because it is the only thing to do. Blue light over the Bois de Boulogne, it continues. The Seine continues. The Louvre stays open, it continues. It hardly closes at all. The Bar Américain continues to be French. De Gaulle continues to be Algerian, as does Camus. Shirley Goldfarb continues to be Shirley Goldfarb. And Jane Hazan continues to be Jane Freilicher, I think. And Irving Sandler continues to be the Banlieue des Artistes, and so do I. Sometimes I think I'm in love with painting. And surely the Piscine de Ligny continues to have water in it, and the floor continues to have tables and newspapers and people under them. And surely we shall not continue to be unhappy. We shall be happy. But we shall continue to be ourselves. Everything continues to be possible. René Char, Pierre Reverdy, Samuel Beckett. It is possible, isn't it? I love Reverdy for saying yes, though I don't believe it. I just wanted to, as I keep reading, read this, the one sort, O'Hara wrote one manifesto, you can call it a manifesto, called Personism, that appeared in, you may have noticed Don Allen appears in the poems, and Don Allen published this anthology called The New American Poetry in 1960, and Personism appears there. And one of the things that O'Hara says, I think, really is helpful in sort of thinking about what happens in his poems and why he puts certain things in there. So I thought I'd just read this short quote before I go on. He writes, "It may be that poetry makes life's nebulous events tangible to me and restores their detail, or conversely, that poetry brings forth the intangible quality of incidents which are all too concrete and circumstantial." So keeping that in mind while we go on, this next one is called Five Poems. "Well now, hold on. Maybe I won't go to sleep at all, and it'll be a beautiful white night. Or else I'll collapse completely from nerves and be calm as a rug or a bottle of pills. Or suddenly I'll be off Montauk, swimming and loving it and not caring where. An invitation to lunch. How do you like that? When I only have 16 cents and 2 packages of yogurt. There's a lesson in that, isn't there? Like in Chinese poetry when a leaf falls. Hold off on the yogurt till the very last when everything may improve." At the Rond-Point, they were eating an oyster, but here we were dropping by sculptures and seeing some paintings. And the smasheroo greats of Cadoré and music by Varèse, too. Well, Adolf Gottlieb, I guess you are the hero of this day, along with venison and Bill. I'll sleep on the yogurt and dream of the Persian Gulf. Which I did. It was wonderful to be in bed again and knock on my door for once signified, hi there. And on the deafening walk through the ghettos where bombs have gone off lately left by subway violators, I knew why I love taxis. Yes, subways are only fun when you're feeling sexy. And who feels sexy after the Blue Angel? Well, maybe a little bit. I seem to be defying fate, or am I avoiding it? This next one is one of the more famous and anthologized poems in the Lunch Poems. And the subject matter is very coherent in and of itself in this poem, and it's a great favorite with me, and I think with a lot of people too. It's called Ave Maria. Mothers of America, let your kids go to the movies. Get them out of the house so they won't know what you're up to. It's true that fresh air is good for the body, but what about the soul that grows in darkness, embossed by silvery images? And when you grow old, as grow old you must, they won't hate you. They won't criticize you. They won't know. They'll be in some glamorous country they first saw on a Saturday afternoon or playing hooky. They may even be grateful to you for their first sexual experience, which only cost you a quarter and didn't upset the peaceful home. They will know where candy bars come from and gratuitous bags of popcorn, as gratuitous as leaving the movie before it's over with a pleasant stranger whose apartment is in the Heaven on Earth building near the Williamsburg Bridge. Oh, mothers, you will have made the little tykes so happy, because if nobody does pick them up in the movies, they won't know the difference. And if somebody does, it'll be sheer gravy, and they'll have been truly entertained either way, instead of hanging around the yard or up in their room hating you prematurely since you won't have done anything horribly mean yet, except keeping them from the darker joys. It's unforgivable, the latter. So don't blame me if you won't take this advice and the family breaks up and your children grow old and blind in front of a TV set, seeing movies you wouldn't let them see when they were young. This next one is called St. Paul and All That. Totally abashed and smiling, I walk in, sit down, and face the Frigidaire. It's April. No, May. It's May. Such little things have to be established in morning after the big things of night. Do you want me to come? When I think of all the things I've been thinking of, I feel insane. Simply, life in Birmingham is hell. Simply, you will miss me, but that's good. When the tears of a whole generation are assembled, they will only fill a coffee cup. Just because they evaporate doesn't mean that life has heat. This various dream of living, I am alive with you, full of anxious pleasures and pleasurable anxiety, hardness and softness, listening while you talk and talking while you read. I read what you read. You do not read what I read, which is right. I am the one with the curiosity. You read for some mysterious reason. I read simply because I'm a writer. The sun doesn't necessarily set. Sometimes it just disappears. When you're not here, someone walks in and says, hey, there's no dancer in that bed. Oh, the Polish summers, those drafts, those black and white teeth. You never come when you say you'll come, but on the other hand, you do come. This one is one of the more sort of out there in terms of, not, you'll notice it's not just things that that he sees. It's called Poem en Forme de Saw. I ducked out of sight behind the sawmill. Nobody saw me because of the falls, the gates, the sluice, the tourist boats. The children were trailing their fingers in the water, and the swans, regal and smarty, were nipping their little fingers. I heard one swan remark, that was a good nip, though they are not as interesting as sausages. And another reply, nor as tasty as those peasants we got away from the elephant that time. But I didn't really care for conversation that day. I wanted to be alone, which is why I went to the mill in the first place. Now I am alone and I hate it. I don't want to just make boards for the rest of my life. I'm distressed. The water is very beautiful, but you can't go into it because of the gunk, and the dog is always rolling over. I like dogs on their little feet. I think I may scamper off to Winnipeg to see Raymond. But what'll happen to the mill? I see cobwebs collecting already, and later those other webs, those awful predatory webs. If I stay right here, I will eventually get into the newspapers. Like Robert Frost. Willow trees. Willow trees, they remind me of Desdemona. I'm so damn literary. And at the same time, the waters rushing past remind me of nothing. I'm so damn empty. What is all this vessel shit anyway? We are all rushing down the river, happy times, ducking, poling, bumping, sinking, and swimming, and we arrive at the beach. The chaff is sand. Alone is a tree bumping another tree in a storm. That's not really being alone, is it? Signed, The Saw. And the next one I'm going to read is the last one in the book, though I'll read one more after it. And you'll notice the movies come back here and they sort of come to life, and the lines of confusion that I was talking about earlier between reading and seeing and living and loving all sort of are performed in this poem. In the first two lines there are two people. There's Adolf Deutsch, who I don't know if you guys know, but he was a musician who made film noir scores. And then Max Steiner, who was the father of film music, who wrote the scores for Casablanca and Gone with the Wind and lots of other movies. So O'Hara was actually trained as a pianist beforehand. So in addition to the art and the poetry and the reading, music is really important here, and the movies. So this one is called Fantasy, and it's dedicated to the health of Allen Ginsberg. How do you like the music of Adolf Deutsch? I like it. I like it better than Max Steiner's. Take his score for Northern Pursuit. The Helmut Dantin theme was, and then the window fell on my hand. Errol Flynn was skiing by. Down, down, down went the grim gray submarine under the cold ice. Helmut was safely ashore on the ice. What dreams, what incredible fantasies of snow farts will this all lead to? I don't know. I have stopped thinking like a sled dog. The main thing is to tell a story. It is almost very important. Imagine throwing away the avalanche so early in the movie. I am the only spy left in Canada. But just because I'm alone in the snow doesn't necessarily mean I'm a Nazi. Let's see. Two aspirins, a vitamin C tablet, and some baking soda should do the trick. That's practically an Alka-Seltzer. Alan, come out of the bathroom and take it. I think someone put butter on my skis instead of wax. Ouch! The lean-to is falling over in the furs, and there is another fatter spy here. They didn't tell me they sent him. Well, that takes care of him. Boy, were those huskies hungry. Alan, are you feeling any better? Yes, I'm crazy about Helmut Dantin, but I'm glad that Canada will remain free. Just free, that's all. Never argue with the movies. And this is the last one I'll read, which is again another one of the most famous poems in the collection, also just called Poem. Lana Turner has collapsed. I was trotting along and suddenly it started raining and snowing, and you said it was hailing, but hailing hits you in the head hard, so it was really snowing and raining, and I was in such a hurry to meet you, but the traffic was acting exactly like the sky, and suddenly I see a headline, Lana Turner has collapsed. There is no snow in Hollywood. There is no rain in California. I have been to lots of parties and acted perfectly disgraceful, but I never actually collapsed. Oh, Lana Turner, we love you. Get up. Thank you. So just really quickly to end, as Laura mentioned in the beginning, one of the ideas of this event is to have you guys go out and write your own lunch poems, right? Which obviously the real ingredients, like, you know, the brilliance and the erudition and the openness and attention and quickness and immediacy and anticipation and surprise, you know, we can all try to get to our best ability. But in the effort of trying to give you guys a little guidance, some guidelines going forward, you can see in the middle of your program, there are a set of constraints which I have written, and in combination, hopefully try to get at some of the energy and juxtaposition and surprise of O'Hara's poems. So I'll just read through them really quickly. If you do choose to go off and write your own poems, please use as many of these as possible, and go ahead and email them to the address at the bottom of the sheet. So here's what I want you guys to put in your lunch poems. One, a description of the contents of your pocket or bag. Two, one food item you or someone you see is eating. Three, one foreign phrase, place name, or the name of a foreign head of state. 4, one instance of personification. 5, the current day and time, and ideally this should interrupt other action in the poem. 6, the weather and your opinion about it. 7, one sentence you hear someone say. 8, one existential question. 9, a comparison of someone you see to a famous person. 10, one thing you wish that you were doing. 11, one literary reference. And 12, your current attitude toward love. So, go forth and write lunch poems. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. And I hope that we see you here again next Friday, same time, same spot, with Wayne Kostenbaum. Thanks. And thank you to Stefania.